Good evening. Thank you all for coming to this third gathering of the Central Banking Series for the Global Interdependence Center here in Madrid. We're pleased to be back and to see such a wonderful turnout. The Global Interdependence Center, for those who are unaware, is a nonprofit based in Philadelphia, housed at the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia. We put on conferences across the United States and around the world, normally between 15 and 20 a year. This year, we've already been Singapore and Hong Kong. We are here in Madrid on May 1st. We will be in Paris for a small gathering roundtable. We will be in Tokyo in November, on November 13th, for a full-day conference there. In the United States, we have events, one on autism on April 10th in Salt Lake City. We have our 35th Annual Monetary and Trade Conference in Philadelphia at Drexel University on April the 21st. In addition, I would like to thank George Chichekos, former dean of the LeBeau School of Business at Drexel University, now a professor who's here with 30 of your students, George. They've been touring Madrid, seeing some of your fine sites and meeting some of your business people, just from the embassy, I believe, the U.S. Embassy. They just arrived. So we'd like to thank them. I would like to personally thank Jorge Silva, from BBVA, Vicente Montes from the Foundation Rafael de Pino, and Manuel Balmaceda, who were extraordinary effort in putting together this, this wonderful program. We're going to have our panelists. I'll introduce our moderator in a second. He's going to introduce the panel, and we'll go for about an hour. There will be time for questions and answers afterwards. I ask the press that is here to hold your questions and answers separately. There'll be a separate media scrum following at 9 o'clock for you to come up front and ask some questions of the remaining panelists. With that, I would like to simply introduce Jose Manuel Gonzalez Paramo, the executive director and the chairman of the International Advisory Committee at BBVA, a former member of the ECB Governing Council, and our moderator for the evening. Thank you very much.
Gracias, Vicente. En representación de la Fundación Rafael del Pino, thank you very much, Michael, for your very kind words. Let me clarify, I'm not a protagonist here. We have three stars, and I will just try to distribute the ball from one to the other. My request to them is that they should have a relatively short initial round of, say, 15 minutes, so that we have enough time for discussing in the table and with you, for the questions with the audience. So. Vicente has spoken about the CVs of our participants today. They are well known anyway, so this spares time. So let me just say that it's a pleasure and a great honor to have here Charles Evans with us, coming from all the way from Chicago, always in the center of the intellectual discussion on issues around monetary policy. I remember the days when the subprime crisis was breaking out, and discussions about securitization in your home, by in Chicago, and it was very good to have this cooperation, by the way, among central banks at that point in time, just to have a common understanding of what was going on. By the way, Global Interdependence Center, what a great name these days. So he will speak first. Then Peter Pryor would follow. Peter Pryor, good friend, companion of sufferings, but also joy from time to time, Peter. Now he represents the board of the ECB and has been a first-hand witness of the unfolding of all the unconventional measures, in particular since the QE was designed and started, but also from well before. And maybe he can illuminate us on the next steps that we have to expect coming from monetary policy. And finally, a good friend of ours, well-known former governor of Bank of Spain, and now, since a number of years, general manager of the BIS, the Bank for International Settlements, is always a great observatory of what goes on in monetary economics and finance. And they, at the BIS, have a doctrine that has been vindicated, by the way, by facts, and I presume that this continues to be the case. So perhaps from this standpoint of international monetary and finance cooperation that the BIS is, and we hope that it will be for many, many, many years ahead, we will have Jaime III. So without further ado, or let me say, for just in case you would plan to skew very key things. There are three, four facts around that raise a lot of questions to observers of macro developments. First of all, we have a number of uncertainties at both sides of the Atlantic, but what is rather new, maybe, is the new administration in the US, and we are trying to understand the economic policy implications of this new administration, name it fiscal policy, trade policies, of course monetary policy, and maybe other aspects like trade or regulation that have an impact on macro developments. Second important thing is, well, it looks like deflation is behind us. You can never be sure, but it looks like this is a thing from the past, and this, I think, vindicates the stance of central banks being extraordinarily accommodative. But there's a big question whether the recent bounce back of inflation is just a temporary thing as on the back of commodity prices and oil, or there is a more substantive, self-sustaining, healthy rate of inflation ahead of us. Third, normalization of policy. And here it is obvious that the Fed has already started to move. The talk has been spoken, and now they are walking the walk. The ECB is at a different point in the rate cycle. And even speaking about rate cycle is a bit too narrow, because the ECB has embarked on QE. And according to the latest communique, QE is there for some time to stay. And there is also an opening to even lower rates, according to the latest press communique. So let's see what our colleagues, and especially Peter, have to say. And finally, of course, geopolitics is a big issue, because from the general consensus on the benefits coming from free trade and globalization, we are now seeing some pockets, or not so small, some points of resistance to this idea that free trade is good. And also China, another element of the geopolitical map, I would say, is showing some signs of, or giving some reasons to worry, because imbalances remain there. Public companies having lacking of strong reforms, and the slowdown at some point could become sharper than we are counting on. So just to put a bit of a background to the discussion, here I stop. Thank you again to all of you, and Charlie, you go first.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you, Jose Manuel, for that kind introduction and setting the stage perfectly from my standpoint. And it's wonderful to be here in Madrid, and I really appreciate all the times that Jose Manuel came to Chicago. I believe it was 2008 when you spoke at our International Banking Conference in the fall. And I don't think you spent as much time with us as we all would have liked, but everybody was very busy during that time period. So it's great to be part of this GIC event and here at the Rafael Del Pino Foundation. It's a magnificent facility. Thanks so much. You know, in the U.S., the setting for monetary policymaking has improved notably since the FOMC took our first rate increase back in December 2015. We've made good progress on our dual mandate objectives. Our responsibilities in the U.S. are to provide monetary and financial conditions to promote maximum employment and price stability. The unemployment rate in the U.S. has fallen to 4.7%, and inflation looks like it's well underway to rising to our 2% objective. I'd like to see it happen little bit sooner than many forecasts, but I think that's a good thing. I still worry that long-term inflation expectations are running below our 2% inflation objective. An important reflection of this progress that we've made is that the federal funds rate path is now confidently upward sloping. Although uncertainties and risks remain, the Fed's risk management capabilities against downside developments have been enhanced by strong fundamentals, stronger expected fiscal support over the medium term, and a median funds rate expectation for the end of 2018 of about 2%. If growth slowed modestly, which is not what we expect, policy could ease by reducing the expected funds rate path, take some of that slope out, or also have an outright rate cut if necessary. Nevertheless, my modal expectation is that U.S. monetary policy will evolve roughly in line with the median summary of economic projections path. Perhaps watching U.S. monetary policy will recede into a more boring spectator sport over the next couple of years. It seems likely that other policy issues in the U.S. will be at least as important. Let me make a few comments about fundamentals in the U.S. Fundamentals in the U.S. are really quite good. Labor markets are vibrant. We've got the unemployment rate down to 4.7%. Labor force participation has been moving sideways, but that's actually a little bit of a positive signal against a downward secular trend. And payroll employment growth has been quite strong, 235,000 recently, and we've been averaging between 175,000 to 225,000 over quite some period of time. This has supported stronger consumer sentiment and spending, and there's also been a modest improvement in wages that's helped support that. Business investment, though, has been disappointing, mostly throughout the slow recovery in the U.S. At best, it's been modest capital expenditures. This always surprises me. As an economist, I know that investment lags the business cycle, and that's sort of the way it goes. But I would have guessed after such a dramatic downturn where the unemployment rate went up to 10%, where consumers were challenged by having larger balance sheets than they really wanted, and they had to work it down, while businesses were able in the U.S. to cut their workforce dramatically. Month after month during the downturn, we got cuts of 600,000, 800,000, until by the summer of 2009, we bottomed out. And businesses had become leaner and were able to work off their balance sheet so that they were strong and they could grow if only there was enough of a spark. And so I would have thought that they would have led the way out to help consumers back to employment and consumer spending. But in fact, it seems as if the headwinds were so strong, the consumer had to make themselves better off, and then that dragged business along. So I'm always surprised by that, but it's mostly been a strong consumer in the U.S. Let me touch on a few topics, and they're quite related to the ones Jose Manuel mentioned. Uncertainty, lower trend growth in the U.S., inflation performance, and our upward sloping funds rate path. First, uncertainties are actually pretty high in the U.S. Uncertainties today are much different than what we faced over much of the post-crisis period, though. During that period, we had our own financial crisis and the uncertainty that came with that, the balance sheets, the consumer mortgage debt, and all of that. On top of that, we had the European sovereign debt crisis beginning in 2010, the U.S. debt limit showdown beginning in 2011. We've suspended the debt limit until just a few weeks from now, so we'll have to see how that proceeds. And the downshift in Chinese growth over recent years, from double-digit growth down to something in single digits. All of these posed important downside risks to the outlook. Today, some downside risks certainly remain, but they don't seem as intense as the list I just rattled off. And what's also different today is that we can point to more notable upside growth potential in many scenarios. Foreign economic growth prospects are looking better than they have for some time. The new administration has many fiscal proposals before Congress. The precise details of any final legislation remain unclear, and we'll have to see how that plays out. For example, tax reform legislation is expected, but many, many details are still up in the air. Although U.S. tax reform may reduce tax inefficiencies for businesses and allow them to focus more directly on better business processes, we should keep in mind that even transitions to a higher level of growth may involve disruptions of existing resources in certain locations. Resources end up being reallocated across sectors, regions, and borders This usually takes time, and the process could involve idling of some resources for a period of time. And that's under the best case scenario. Now, this brings me to the status of trend growth in the U.S. As I've spoken on for over a year now, trend growth for the U.S. is going to remain lower than most would prefer, most in the U.S. for sure. Changing this requires some truly astounding turnarounds in demographic and technological trends. Remember, the long-run sustainable growth in an economy is determined by the growth rates in its labor input and the productivity of that labor. Now, this is just simple arithmetic. So in the U.S., where I run into many people who, you know, are constantly sort of saying, you know, why can't we have 3 or 4% growth? For 3 or 4% to be sustainable, you need more sustainable growth in the labor input and also in productivity. Unfortunately, we've seen a decline in both of these factors relative to the 1982 to 2007 period. What I'm saying is not new information. It's been in the papers, many academic articles, business press, and all that. But it's often overlooked in rosy economic scenarios. The trend in labor force participation in the U.S. has been declining for over 15 years. Baby boomers are retiring. Men have less attachment to the workforce as they grow older. Female participation rates have plateaued, and participation by 18 to 24-year-olds has declined. Maybe they're working harder at school and not doing the part-time job like they used to. This won't turn around soon. It just isn't possible to instantaneously birth a large cohort of qualified 25-year-olds in the U.S. We've also seen slower growth in labor productivity. Improvements in labor quality, that is, gains in education and experience, are no longer adding much to productivity in the aggregate. That used to be a big driver of stronger productivity growth in the U.S. Business investment has been relatively weak, resulting in only modest capital deepening in recent years. And the pace of technological increase appears to have slowed. Total factor productivity growth seems to have reverted back to the slow pace of the 1973 to 95 period after a surge in capital-embodied technological change in the late 1990s and strong gains from incorporating that technology into better business practices in the early 2000s. Of course, it would be great to double our 1.75% trend rate of GDP growth, but unless this is accompanied by sustainable structural improvements in labor and productivity growth, such GDP growth would eventually put strong pressure on resources and drive up wages and prices. Clearly, in that situation, financial markets and the Fed's focus on our dual mandate responsibilities would ultimately lead to more restrictive financial conditions. Now, regarding inflation performance, this will depend a lot on how the fiscal and international issues play out, as well as monetary and financial policies. So I always think it's important to keep in mind a basic rudimentary inflation equation. That is, inflation determinants tend to be past performance of inflation. There's a lot of inertia. The lagged inflation is important. Transitory factors, changes in relative prices that are not expected to persist, like changes in energy prices, food prices, commodity prices. The Phillips curve, resource slack, and how that changes inflation. And then long-term inflation expectations are very important. Long-term inflation expectations remain low. My inflation outlook has a sustained increase to 2% only by 2019. Burst of growth and greater pressure on resources would accelerate inflation's evolution. As inflation increases, it will be important to remember that the FOMC's long-run price stability goal is a symmetric 2% objective for PCE inflation. As always, the FOMC will look for sustained progress to 2%. Given transitory relative price adjustments going back to the fall of 2014, I expect energy price rebounds will carry headline PCE inflation higher for a time than its underlying rate. This is why focusing on underlying inflation is so important. In 2015 in the U.S., PCE inflation, the headline number, was less than 1%. But the Fed didn't ease, and we saw underlying inflation is higher than that, so we didn't have to respond to that. Core inflation is a better gauge of sustained inflation pressures, a better indication of where inflation, headline inflation, is likely to head next year. And I don't expect core PCE inflation to achieve 2% until 2019. Now, this brings me to my views on appropriate monetary policy. An upward-sloping funds rate path and solid fundamentals make for a noticeably improved rate-setting environment. So I think in your seats is a handout on the Fed dot chart from our summary of economic projections, and it shows the upward-sloping median of the funds rate over this year, next year, and 2018. So an upward-sloping funds rate path and solid fundamentals make for a noticeably improved policy setting environment. Rate increases are expected in 2017 and 18. The median summary of economic projections submission has a funds rate at around 2% at the end of 2018. Now, this is a gradual path. We're currently targeting a range for the funds rate of 0.75% to 1%. The midpoint of that is 88 basis points. If growth and expectations pick up so that core inflation rises further, a sturdier economy would be able to handle a steeper path of rate increases. Since even an inflation rate of 2.5% for a time is consistent with our symmetric inflation objective, this is a reasonably acceptable risk path. Indeed, the best way to assuredly get to 2% is to do so faster and with momentum. The credible upward-sloping funds rate path is helpful in this regard. Now, if the economy faltered somewhat and inflation remained well below 2%, monetary policy could provide some additional accommodation simply by lowering the expected path of increases and conveying this in our summary of economic projections policy communications. In model simulations, this additional forward guidance has some reasonable degree of effectiveness. And if more is required at some later date, we could also reduce the higher funds rate, providing additional direct accommodation. Unfortunately, there will likely be somewhat substantial uncertainty over the precise extent of accommodation. That is, although the long-run neutral funds rate is about 3% according to the median SEP, the shorter and medium-run R-star is likely lower than 1% for a time. So accordingly, a funds rate of 2% in 2018 might be less accommodative than would be expected in the long run. And some of the steady path of increases envisioned for the funds rate represents an expectation of chasing a gradually rising path for R-star upwards. In such a case, gradual increases in line with this increase in R-star would simply maintain the monetary policy stance. So I'm quite optimistic that the U.S. setting is much better than it's been in past years, and that we should be raising the funds rate over the next couple of years. I have some other comments prepared on our unconventional policies, but I think I'll hold back because we'll probably get into that, so try to reserve some time for question and answers. So thanks very much.
Someone mentioned that monetary policy was supposed to be boring, and it has not been the last years. It has been quite interesting, let me say. So very pleased to be here and try to explain a little bit the situation as I see it. 17 years, it's 2007, that's 10 years from now. We had the peak of the credit cycle, the financial cycle. That's 10 years already. And then we had the bust. I entered central banking in the year 2000, so I had the biggest part of the boom in financial cycle, and then I had the bust, and in between I had to face, you know, the management of huge institutions collapsing in my country. I mean, institutions being out of proportion compared to the GDP. If you took the balance sheet of a conglomerate like Fortis or Dexia, these were multiples of the GDP. So we had, as in many other countries like Ireland, Iceland, and other countries, you know that Jaime also in Spain. But Spain, when I compare the problems we had in our country and the response that we had at that time, I can say that looking backwards, quite happy about the limited consequences of the liquidation of these big institutions. Because one, we could sell to BNP Paribas, which was Fortis, and the other, Dexia, is still jointly managed the legacy with our French colleagues there. But you see, in the first years, the boom years of the crisis, before the crisis, and then the bust years, what's really striking is that there was no really preparation to face a financial crisis. And I think that Jaime is working since years. I've been in the Basel environment also for years, basically in the boom years. But I think that's the first lesson. The second point, of course, is since we were unprepared for such crisis, monetary policy had to play a dominant role. And I think I would call it a curse, une malédiction, because this is something that central banks didn't want really to play. Fiscal policy, as you know, was very limited because public debts were also already very high pre-crisis. And in the crisis like Spain, for example, public debt increased. You remember Spain had a AAA before the crisis, and into the first years of the crisis, it was close, you know, not with investment grade, as you know. And so the speed at which these things can happen is really something amazing. I think for the public in general, it should always be remembered that without the central banking action, we would have been in depression. I really believe that. And central banks intervened. The problem with central banks usually is that the interest rate at the beginning of the crisis were already very low. And so it was quite difficult to stimulate the economy because when you have the downside, you know, of a financial cycle, usually demand is very compressed. People want to reimburse the debt. You get financial stress in the system, banking stress. And so you need to have very accommodative policies, demand management policies. And fiscal policy was really already in, I wouldn't say trouble, but difficulties before the crisis. And central bank in general had very low interest rates at the beginning. So I think it's important to realize that central banks explored uncharted territories. I mean, US, of course, was the first, compared to us, of course, in quantitative easing, for example. And we took example for the Fed at some point. So it is, again, very important to remember that without the action of central banks, you would have been in a terrible situation and we would not be here today in the same environment. I think we would have gone through very major political changes there. So my first point. Now, things have evolved quite favorably, and we have tried in Europe to create institutions to avoid, you know, to manage and to avoid a repetition of these sort of phenomena of financial crisis. So we have now the SSM, we have a resolution board also, so a number of institutions have been created in between, in the crisis. These institutions also dealing with sovereign debt crisis, like the ESM, are not fully completed today. But still, we can say that the institutional environment has improved very much. Second point. The third point, what about the business cycle now? And how are things evolving? Now, the last leg of the financial crisis was very recent. So I talk about 2007 as the peak of the crisis. But many of you maybe have not realized that we have the third shock that we had in the financial crisis was the emerging market crisis. And that was exactly 1 year ago. So 1 year ago, we had a new shock in the world economy. And that was very well understood by the G20. When the G20 met, I think it was Shanghai, in February of last year, it was Shanghai. In February of last year, they communicated a shared assessment of the world economy. And in that shared assessment, it was notably said that downside risk and vulnerability have risen. We will use all policy tools individually and collectively. And monetary policy, of course, cannot lead to balanced growth. So other policies like structural policies had to be also put in place. But I think what is important is this shared assessment that we had at the worldwide level. That monetary policy had to be used, fiscal policy if it was possible, and structural policy as well. But that was 1 year ago. So the US, I think, Charles, you could confirm that led to a sort of pause in the monetary policy tightening at that time, because you had begun a tightening cycle before we had these emerging market issues. I mean, it's not with his head. So monetary policy tightening cycle was pushed further away and starts again now. I mean, but you will comment on that. I think it's quite important. On our side, we had a strong reaction first in December where the market was disappointed, and then in March we reinforced the measures we took. And I think it's safe to say that we could, again, avoid a major slowdown of economies in general, thanks to the reaction of the policy reaction. Now, the last G20 meeting that you have seen, reaffirms a number of the commitments that had been taken 1 year earlier. It's still the March 2017 communique of the G20, reiterate the determination of the G20 to use all policy tools, etc., etc. So that sentence is taken back by the G20, the major economies of the planet, having a shared assessment that 1 year after the emerging market shock, still there was room for be cautious in policy and even using the instrument to try to put this economy, the world economy, on a more normal path. What is normal remains to be seen, but a more normal and less fragile path. They also reiterated, the G20, that downside risks are still there. I mean, downside risks have not disappeared, and even if, to some extent, they have improved. That's not what they say. The IMF will discuss in a few weeks' time also the balance of risk. What we say in Europe, in the euro area, is risks are more balanced on growth, so it's going better, but still risks are tilted to the downside. The communique of the G20 goes a step further, saying that the downside risks still persist. Now, in the IMF discussion, and that will be an important discussion, what do we mean with downside risk to the world economy? And then I will talk about monetary policy. But what do we mean with downside risk? I would say that in the short run, for cyclical reasons in Europe, the downside risks have clearly diminished. And I would say, even from a business cycle point of view, there are some upside risk on the projections. So the Q1 and Q2 of this year are quite good. And they may surprise a little bit on the positive side. Remains to be seen. On the other hand, if you take a little bit longer perspective about the risk, you would conclude that downside risks are still very persistent. And basically, this has to do with the fact that structural reforms have stopped, you know, in most countries of the world. There have been quite a number of structural reforms in countries like Spain also in the environment of the crisis. But when things started to go better, we see a sort of pause, or we call it also structural reform fatigue, in a number of countries. I see Cathy Mann is also here. I mean, the OECD is also one of the messages you have expressed, is that structural reforms, you know, has slowed down in a number of countries recently. And we see that a major risk for the world economy in general, but also for the European economies, this sort of stop in structural reforms, of course, because monetary policy cannot address these issues, of course. Now, when we look a little bit about our projections, we are more confident in our projections. So we see basically the figures are the same as the one we had a few months ago, but we are more confident in these figures. In spite of the fact that oil prices have increased, in spite of the fact that the real disposable income of households, the growth has diminished because basically inflation has gone up and the nominal disposable income has not accelerated. So the real disposable income has slowed down a little bit above 1%. But basically what we think is that the savings rate of households, in spite of what we hear very often, negative interest rate, the savings rate of household is going to diminish and absorb the increase of oil prices. Why do we say that? First, because consumer confidence is very high in our service. Second, we also see that the growth of disposable income in Europe is basically relying on employment growth. Not the wages so much, but employment growth in most countries. And this is a good surprise. And the richer the disposable income in terms of employment, the higher the propensity to consume. Okay? Because employment, one unit of employment consumes more than one unit of equivalent of wages in general. So you have a positive impact on consumption. And the first reason, and this is surprising for many, is that the construction sector is recovering everywhere, also in Spain. And the recovery, of course, leads also to consumption. If you buy a house, or if you do, there are a number of things you buy to reshape the house or that go into the new construction, etc. So you have a number of reasons why you have this projection about consumption. Investment has been recovering as well. Business investment has been recovering. If you look at Spain, for example, also business investment is recovering. We think that this recovery is relatively weak given in terms of stocks, given the fact that investment has really collapsed with the crisis. the rate of growth of investment that you see now is more or less in line with domestic demand, with consumption. That's the accelerator model. But it's relatively weak when you think about the stock of capital which has been shrunk, which has been reduced in the crisis, meaning that the stock of capital per employee is much lower now, the stock, than it was at the beginning of the crisis. So the flows are more or less okay. But if you think in terms of stock of capital, it's not okay. There's still a big lag here. Now this opens a big discussion. Now, the flows are okay, as I say, in terms of GDP growth, in terms of disposable income, in terms of employment. What about the stock adjustment? I mentioned a little bit about the investment, but what about the legacy of the crisis? That's the second. And then I will conclude on monetary policy. If you look at stocks in general, you see that the balance sheet adjustment in Europe, the balance sheet adjustment to the excess, you know, the boom of credit, is not yet finished, unfortunately. We have made a lot of progress in the balance sheet adjustment of households, of non-financial corporations in Spain in particular, where the degree of indebtedness of Spanish firms has been reduced enormously in Spain. But still, we believe that the stock adjustment of non-financial corporations in the euro area as a whole is not yet finished. The banks also, leveraged institutions. For the banks also, we think that the recapitalization of banks, the reduction of leverage of banks has progressed pretty well. But the adjustment is not yet finished, as you know. And the low profitability of the bank in that environment makes it complicated, of course, to finalize the recapitalization of the banking system in Europe. So that remains also a point of attention. We certainly will discuss about that. And then you get, of course, the indebtedness of sovereigns. And the indebtedness of sovereigns is certainly not satisfactory. And we plateau in Europe around close to 100% of GDP. But of course, with big difference, where Germany has a low debt ratio that influences the average. But the debt ratios and the debt sustainability remains of a number of countries remains an issue. Now, what about monetary policy and all that? I think monetary policy will benefit more in the future of the fact that we have now a single supervisor in Europe, that we have a better resolution framework, which has not, by the way, been really tested now. But our institutions have been improved. They are not finalized, unfortunately. I think that remains a big risk in our environment. But we have progressed very much in the institutional reforms in Europe. Unfortunately, they are not completed, so I would not be fully satisfied by that. In monetary policy, basically what we did at the last meeting is first to acknowledge that the economy is doing better, in spite of the fact that the projections have not really changed compared to what they were 3 months before. But we basically say that we have more confidence. We change the language to signal our more optimistic view on the economy. Not so long time ago, we talked about a moderate but fragile recovery. Then we say, well, it's moderate, it's steady, so steady growth. Then we say it's firming. And now we say it's firming and broadening also. What do we mean with firming and broadening? Well, we see when you look across countries, almost all countries are growing now. The dispersion across countries has been reduced, so they all grow above the potential, so a bit below 2%. Spain is above. And also across sector. You see also when you look into sectors, manufacturing, construction, and services, but within manufacturing, within services, construction is a bit different, but you see that the economies are growing. So we also have communicated that. See Diego there. You have worked, someone of the staff, a Spanish colleague here, has worked a lot on this idea of broadening the recovery. It gives us all confidence. Why do we maintain the very accommodative monetary policy stance, and why did we, in our guidance, reaffirm exactly the same, the guidance, and we repeated the guidance about rates, low or lower, also about our intention to continue our purchase program until the end of this year or beyond if needed. Why did we do that? Well, basically because this recovery that I mentioned here is conditional upon very easy monetary and financial conditions in general. So they are conditioned on the policy that we follow now. So we are going to look, of course, of the firming of recovery. If you take accommodation, are you getting the same results? Did the economy reach the, what some call the escape velocity, where you don't need support? We don't believe that in the Governing Council that we have reached that stage yet. As well for growth, as well for inflation. We say, as Charlie also mentioned, for the United States, which is more advanced, much more advanced in the cycle than we are, because we had two recessions, actually. You had the first one, the 2009, but we had a double dip in Europe. We say that we are not yet at this stage, but we start to communicate a number of more positive messages on the economy. But we say it's still conditional on. So we also say that it's premature to talk about exit. It is these policies have to continue for a while, and we are reassessing the situation constantly. And the forward guidance, that for that reason, has not been changed in the last Governing Council. Now, that we have to prepare for the future, yes, that's always true, that we have to prepare for the time when we exit, that's also always true. But the time has not yet come now to change our policy stance. But we are going to see if the confidence indicators that are very good, actually, will be confirmed by hard data. And then we will see a little bit how the cycle evolves during this year. It's a crucial year, as many years, they're all crucial years. And this is a year where we start seeing light at the end of the tunnel. But it's still some way away, and we have to be cautious. There have been a lot of discussion. Let me explore to conclude, because I know I get the questions from journalists and others about sequencing. Are you going to first finish your purchase program and then increase the rates, or which is in our forward guidance, or wouldn't you do the opposite? The only thing I want to say is that the policy rate today, the monetary policy rate today, is a deposit facility rate. It is the deposit facility rate. When you have an excess liquidity close to 2 trillion of euros in the system, the money market rates that determine the risk-free curve all over the curve is a DFR, is a deposit facility rate, which is minus 40 basis points. Any communication on the deposit facility rate is a signal on the monetary policy stance. And there should be no ambiguity on this. That's why we are very careful about any signal about the DFR, because that's the policy rate that you have today. The logic in the US, I say personally, and I think that's shared, the logic in the US to start first tapering when the day comes and then to move the interest rate is very logic. The logic is very strong. And I say, of course, we have a package where you use at the same time rates and purchases of assets. So it's a combination that leads to the financial conditions which support the economy, of course. But you have to be very careful in the guidance that you have, because all the signals that you may give on the short-term rates will influence the whole risk-free curve. So you have to be very careful on this. And I say the logic is a very strong logic to start, as we say in the guidance. Of course, you always reassess the situation, because we also say this is an expectation. Of course, with all the information we have, you never know what can happen. But this is the most likely thing that will happen. I think there is, as I repeat again, a strong logic in the sequence of our forward guidance. And I think I take this opportunity to say it again. Thank you.
Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for the invitation. I would like to start saying that I am going to take a different perspective, talking about monetary policy. The BIS is not an institution that has to decide in a couple of months whether rates are going to be higher or lower. And what we do is to try to analyze with a medium-term perspective, or I would say even a longer-term perspective, certainly longer than the horizon that usually central banks have to take the measures. What is the lessons that we can derive from what has happened so far, and what is that tells us about some of the challenges that we face in the future, that central banks face in the future? So I think I would like to group these challenges in two main groups. One that is more longer term, that is to some extent what are the lessons in terms of the mandates, in terms of the practice of central banking. And the other one is more the challenges associated with the transition to a more normal monetary policy that has started already in one country to get into the normalization at a gradual pace. In the first group, it's something that, as we have repeated many, many times, financial stability deserves more prominence, and central banks need to integrate better financial stability concerns, financial cycle, financial booms and busts, integrate that much better into their policy frameworks. The BIS was saying that before the crisis and has continued to say that, and it will continue to say that for some time. The second, perhaps, lesson, and you can see that despite the title, Monetary Policy in a New Economic Environment, this is not for the new economic environment, this is also for the old economic environment, this is for all economic environments. This is a more long-lasting kind of conclusions. The second is that the experience with prolonged monetary policy accommodation has highlighted that there are some limits on monetary policy, and that there are risks of overburdening monetary policy. And I think on these past few years, there has been some overburdening of central banks. One of the expressions that you may have heard is, this is the only game in town. It's not a good balance to have recovery with just one game in town. And I wouldn't say that even if it is more than one, it should not be, from my perspective, the main game in town. And the third also lesson is that central banks need to incorporate better the spillovers and of their actions into the rest of the world, and how these interactions come back to their own country. And this is something that I would say that in both things that I have mentioned, the financial stability and the spillovers, progress has been done. We tend to think that still more work, and there is more conceptual work that needs to be done. We don't have an analytical framework that allows us to incorporate these kind of elements to monetary policy. Now, the other group, which is what are the challenges facing in the transition to the new normal, I think probably we would have had this discussion 1 year ago, perhaps. Probably we would be talking about secular stagnation. I think today this is much less prominent in any kind of discussion, and probably people is talking more about reflation and what is the meaning of reflation. In any case, whatever is the meaning, and we are not thinking that there will be a big inflation or something like that, provided that the globalization continues to moderate some of the pressures in terms of prices. The case for prolonging extreme accommodation in advanced economies is weakening as these disinflationary pressures are receding. And there are risks also to the upside. There is the risk that we don't know, that probably mainly associated with some of the uncertainties associated with some policy measures that we don't know how they are going to evolve. So the uncertainties about policies, policy uncertainties, if you want, political uncertainties are pretty high. There could be more expansionary fiscal policies in countries that are close to full employment. That could be one trigger of additional inflation. There is also the rise or the risk of protectionism. Certainly, as I said before, part of the pressure to keep down inflationary pressures is globalization. Without that, with more fragmentation, could be more risk in the upward direction in terms of inflation. That is one of the challenges. Managing that is one of the challenges. Second, and Peter mentioned that in some countries it has started, is emerging markets. They are managing financial cycles. Some of these financial cycles are turning. One of them, big one, 1 year or 2 years ago, But there are others that have had also financial cycles that are maturing. That has implications in the world. And the third element that I would like to mention is that the pace of normalization should not only take into account this downside risk that exists, certainly, but also the upside risks. And in any case, as the uncertainty, as I associated that risks to some of the policy measures, as there is a significant uncertainty, I think we should think about this process of normalization, even with the best of communications. I think the central banks are doing a great job in terms of communicating properly what is their purpose and their objectives and what they are going to do. Even with the best of communication, I think we should be ready for some bumpiness, some bumpy road ahead of us. And I think this should not change course. The path of normalization is an important path that at some point of time will have to be followed. And it has started. So let me just focus on a few of the points that I have mentioned. I said that financial stability need to be integrated better integrated into monetary policy. For sure, prudential and macroprudential are two of the main elements and need to play a role, an important role in financial stability, but we tend to think that they improve the resilience of the financial system, et cetera, but we think that monetary policy has a complementary role. The price of leverage, that's an interest rate, is very important, that plays a complementary role. We have seen that macroprudential policies tend to be more forceful when they go in the same direction as monetary policy. So one policy that we have been defending is leaning against the wind, which indicates that monetary policy integrates and leans against the buildup of financial imbalances. What we have found is in our analysis is that if this is not done suddenly when you think that you have risk, but continuously, systematically along a long period of time, this produces some positive results, not only in terms of financial stability, but also in terms of managing the economy. Lower variability on the output and a better control of the whole process of the other objectives of the main objectives, I would say, of central banks. Now, on the limits of monetary policy, I would just to say that this is a very complex recession. This is a balance sheet recession, and balance sheet recession is characterized by a number of elements. One of them is too much debt after the before the crisis. So it's a business cycle that, and there is a boom that is overimposed to the business cycle. So the situation is a lot of debt. And in addition, the financial system tends to be impaired. So the efficiency of the monetary policy, one of the channels, which is the credit channel, is not as efficient as usual. That doesn't say that monetary policy has not to provide accommodation. It's obvious that they will have to provide accommodation. The important point is that you need to analyze the balance of risks and benefits, and over time, at the beginning is obvious. I think I fully agree with Peter. If the central banks had not reacted the way they did it so swiftly and so clearly, we would be in a worst, in a nightmare, we would be in a great recession. The problem is over time. I think the balance of risks become different, and the consequences of keeping low interest rates for long have also to be taken into consideration, and that's a really not a very easy balance to make. We have analyzed that the credit growth, rapid credit growth, these booms also influence the real economy through a misallocation of resources. Misallocation of resources implies that in these credit booms, some resources, too much resources are allocated to sectors that are in the bubble and will come down. And this implies that this affects productivity growth. So in addition to all the reasons of why productivity growth is low, there is an additional reason that is associated with the financial cycle, which is booms tend to create this misallocation of resources and therefore tend to create this lower productivity growth. What we have found, and it was interesting, is that first the amount is significant, so it could explain an important part of this decline of productivity growth that started well before the crisis, and second, that it is persistent after the bust. So it persists after the bust, and I think this is an important element of why it is important to consider also the risks of keeping the price of leverage low for an excessive period of time. And my third element that I was mentioning was the global spillovers. I think we are in a globalized world. We need to, the risks are of a global nature. What the big central banks do have global implications, and it is very important that these spillovers are considered in taking these decisions. Sometimes we tend to think that it is not enough to have your house in order. You have to contribute to have the neighborhood in order. That is, you need to have to also contribute that the situation is, and even for your own interest, because this will feed back to you. So I would like to finish with my reflection on the transition to the new normal. I already mentioned that we would not be discussing reflation. We will be discussing secular stagnation. We at the BIS, we have never bought completely this secular stagnation. We think there are some elements, of course, and it was mentioned before, some of the demographic elements these are. But we think that really more than a kind of structural deficient of aggregate demand in the world, what we have had is that we have had some bias and some asymmetry in dealing with financial cycles. We tend to not to do enough in the booms and then to do too much in the busts. And the result is a bias towards lower rates that and lower productivity contributions to that, that at the end can affect global growth. So this is what we have been saying, and again, it is arguable, but our finding of productivity growth, I think, is an interesting finding. Finally, I would like to come back to the what I said at the beginning. This is the process of normalization has started. Each central bank has to do it according to their own situation. It is very important that it is done gradually, but at the same time it is very important that it is steady. There has been a long time with interest too low. We have seen how some imbalances have built up. Particularly, we tend to think that the leverage at the global level has increased substantially. It's more than 40% more points of GDP of debt in the global world that at the moment of the crisis. If at that point of time we were concerned about that, we should be, we should continue to be concerned. The point I am trying to make is that it would be much better to have a combination of policies that would not place so much burden on monetary policy. It would be much, much better if all the reforms, etc., would have been done. And we have been able to postpone, and to monetary policy can, to some extent, give you a little bit of time, but if you don't use the time to do the reforms, what we find is that we don't solve the problems. Part of the demand problem and growth problem have much more deeper roots than just a deficit of demand. It's much more rooted and need to be addressed properly. So I think there's a delicate balance. A firm and steady normalization, I think, is the way to go, and it is. It will be very important to contain potential upside risk also, and particularly it will be very important to contain potential financial stability issues down the road. Thank you very much.
Okay, very well. I was just checking. We have a
close to 45 minutes to discuss the very many points that have been made. So in order to break the ice, let me start with two questions to each of the panelists, just to warm up friends that are at the other side. Very simple and short questions. First of all, Charlie, on unemployment, I think recently you've made a defense of being gradual in the exit, and perhaps to the point of going beyond the unemployment target for a while just to push inflation a little bit up. Could you expand on this? This has a connection with the Evans rule. You may explain. And second, on the debt limit, I've just read that the Congressional Budget Office has made some numbers and said, okay, this will not be an issue until October. But when it comes, is that timing realistic, and to what extent would this impact on your policy?
Sure.
Okay. All right, so the unemployment rate has come down quite dramatically in the U.S., and you mentioned Evans and forward guidance. Back in 2012, the Fed embarked on open-ended asset purchases, so-called QE3, and that was in September. Then in December, we said, oh, by the way, you know, we're going to keep the funds rate, you know, where it is at least until the unemployment rate goes below 6.5%. And at that time, in September, we were sort of looking at a forecast where we thought that we might go quite some time and it would stick at 8%. So then the Bank of England adopted something close to that, and they had a 7% guideline for that. Now we're at 4.7%. Most FOMC participants' estimates of the natural rate of unemployment are in the range of 4.75%. And so as we go below that, we will be undershooting our objective. Now, you know, the Federal Reserve Act says we're supposed to pursue maximum employment. It doesn't say we're supposed to shut things off all of a sudden when we get to the natural rate. But as an economist, I think that things begin to go askew if you go too far below this. I would say there is uncertainty as to what this rate is. My economists, looking at labor force dynamics, have, you know, sort of argued, I think, pretty well that the composition of people in occupations is going to be skewed towards more people who have lower unemployment rates, and so I think you could argue it might be 4.5%. At any rate, there's a lot of uncertainty, and I think the key goal for us is to make sure that we get inflation to 2%. So the resource slack is not going to get inflation up to 2% very quickly. The Phillips curve is very flat. So I think that focusing on inflation and perhaps more volatility, you know, other things that may be going on or really should be the focus of policy as we increase, unless something changes quite a lot. Now, you mentioned the debt limit. There is this additional law in the U.S. It's not only the fact that our Congress and the President appropriate funds and say, go spend this amount, apparently, to actually write valid checks. The entire, you know, debt has to be below something, and so there's this double limit. And back in 2011, we, you know, got ourselves into a lot of difficulties in terms of agreeing to expand the debt limit, political brinksmanship, game of chicken, and people trying to get things into legislation that they otherwise found difficult. I would hope that you know, the Trump administration, the Republicans are in charge of Congress and the administration, so presumably they can all agree to just not have that cause any future problems, and we all focus on the important thing about continuing to have the economy grow strongly and get inflation up to 2%.
Thank you. Peter, for you. You mentioned this idea, Jaime, also, the monetary policy, the only game in town. Mm. And this is a very special thing in the Eurozone, to the extent that the ECB is a central bank without the state. To what extent this policy design makes credible that at some point monetary policy is not going to be the only game in town? Because when one looks at politicians, they seem a bit relaxed. You take some steam. Is there a big problem, or put it in a different way? Could you imagine ECB saying, no matter what, I will exit at this point in time, contingent on these indications, and you do what you have to do?
Well, you allude indirectly, for those who understand, to fiscal dominance situation where the exit would be very difficult because of potential consequences on public finances, because rates go up, you know, high indebtedness. I think I call it the acid test, of course. All these measures have been designed, you know, to deal with the inflation and to respond to an inflation problem. Now, of course, we will continue like this. When the Governing Council will assess that, you know, the path of inflation is sustainable, then you will withdraw accommodation, whatever the consequence, public finance. So usually we give the message to other authorities that they have to also be prepared for the time where interest rate will increase. Are they listening or not? I don't know. Maybe not sufficiently. But what I'm sure of is when we will take the decision, we will be faced with a decision. If we see, if our verdict, our assessment is that you have reached this, you know, path, sustained path of inflation towards 2%, close, we will take the decision. I have no doubt on this. And so we have done that in the past. We will continue to do it like this. But I say the acid test will one day will come, as you say. But government should know that. Now, the only game in town is a curse, of course. In malédiction, I say it's a curse because you never wanted that. And as I explained before, you go in an extremely severe financial crisis. There are very weak institutions dealing with banking crisis, especially for cross-border banking crisis. It's very weak. So what does the central bank? Basically provide liquidity to the banking system or the banking systems. Provide liquidity. Now you hope that the adjustment will come and the other authorities will work on that. You know how long it took also in Spain to really really tackle the problems, because it was very difficult in the beginning to know the extent of the crisis. But some countries acted relatively quickly. I was alluding, things were different. I don't want to say that one did better than the other, although it's true that the assessment of the situation makes it sometimes it's lagging. So the ECB has been confronted to a situation with very weak institutions dealing with financial crisis, and has been let to be the only game in town to participate. You know, we call it in liaison with the IMF and the Commission in Troika, which is not really something you like to do. And head of state and governments have given the supervision to the ECB. And the ECB, of course, has done what the politicians, when they broadened the responsibility of the central bank, we took it. And there was a lot of efforts to do that. Now, we hope that this banking union will be completed, because we have supervision in the central bank. We don't have the backstop. This is, of course, for government. So they give you supervision, but the backstop remains essentially national. So that's something I cannot be very happy as a central banker. They have the backstop. That means also that national consideration play an important role, as long as you don't mutualize. This is some way to go, but it's not a very... And the other one is the sovereign debt. We had a sovereign debt crisis, as you explained, a central bank without a state, that's what you say. That makes it much more difficult also. And moreover, we had banking system highly exposed to the country, because the banks lent within the country mostly. And second, they had a package of government debt on the asset side. So you go in a situation where there is no institution dealing with sovereign debt crisis in that union. We have a banking systems which are very exposed to their national economy and to public debt in particular. Then you get all the ingredients for a very, very big crisis. And when I look backward, I can say, wow, it could have been much worse. I really believe that, much, much worse than what we had. And in 2012, it was a stop, not only because of the words of the president, but also because support of politicians. Now, what happens after? So you support the economy, you continue, and Jaime has a point, of course. At some point, you know, you would like to see the other actors tackle the real problems which were behind the cycle. That means the slowdown of productivity, which started before the crisis, the misallocation of resource, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So monetary policy is not going to solve all these things. It buys you time. It avoids, you know, extreme stress to materialize in financial crisis that you can do. It supports demand, yes, it supports demand. But beyond that, there is not much. And that's the warning also, the warnings of the BIS, rightly.
Thank you. You also replied to the second I was about to make, which has to do with banking union and monetary policy. Oh, so thank you. Yeah. Jaime, two things. On emerging market economies, you mentioned them. In the past, one of the root causes of crisis was the mismatch in currencies. To what extent do you think that policymakers have been sensitive to that so that they are better protected than in the past against the volatility of the dollar, let's say? And the second has to do with the leaning against the wind, because I think intuition says, okay, there is a lot of wisdom in that. The BIS, I think, should be more open in promoting this view that there are benefits that are hidden in the usual discussion. But how could you embody in a relatively simple rule this philosophy? How can you explain to policymakers, okay, this is to the benefit of the economy, but now there is a, say, modified Taylor rule or something that could, in a way, make simple what is an attractive idea, leaning against the wind?
Yes, one of the concerns that we have had is not only the overall volume of debt of the global economy, recognizing some deleveraging here and there, particularly Spain, UK, United States in some areas. I think what we have seen is that, for example, the debt in dollars issued by non-residents in United States is now 10.5 trillion, and it has been growing. Now, part of it could be hedged in a natural hedge if they are exporters that they receive some dollars. But it would be very difficult that this is a total hedge, and part of it is not hedged, and there is not that much information on that. Out of that, 3.6 is emerging markets. 3.6 billion is emerging markets. So this adds to the complexity of the situation, because obviously they are very sensitive. Financial conditions will be extremely sensitive, not only to movements of interest rates, but also to movements of the dollar. Any increase of the dollar tightens enormously the financial conditions for these issuers of debt. A significant part is done by capital markets, and a significant part has nothing to do with American banks, is done through other banks. So this is really indicating the important role of the dollar as a global currency, where many banks and many asset managers participate and is active. So this is certainly one of the elements that we need to continue to monitor. We thought last year that it was peaking, but no, it has continued to move up. Now, in terms of the leaning against the wind, I think we have done some interesting exercises by enhancing a little bit some rules, tailored rule, by adding financial cycle dimension, by adding one measure of leverage and by adding one measure of debt service. With these two elements, done in a continuous way, not responding to the moment where, because usually when you enter in these discussions, usually the answer is, no, if you now raise rates, you create a chaos, the cost of the economy would be much larger than what the benefits, blah, blah, blah. And I think this is right. If you do it at a certain point, when you discover that there is a situation that is already damaging. But that's not the point we are making. What we are saying is, let's do it continuously, in this, gradually, very gradually, following this kind of introducing into the monetary policy some kind of element that adds this financial cycle dimension. We tend to think, and there is a couple of reports that we have published, that it not only helps, it doesn't remove the crisis, frankly speaking. If you move backwards, the crisis would have been smaller, but we would have had some kind of problem, but it would have been smaller. And the benefit in terms of output growth and in terms of inflation also would have been better. Of course, you can make with analysis, you can backtest and do many things. but I think there is some support from these numbers that support what I think is an interesting idea, as you said, which is it is important to lean against the buildup of financial imbalances from the beginning and not waiting to clean up the mess afterwards.
Unless you have a very pressing desire to reply to each other or to nuance what you said before,